ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, four people vanished. It was dubbed a death cult. But after months of investigation, I don't think it's that simple. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nanup 4, a story of people drawn into a 20-year saga they didn't ask for, who have spent decades trying to reconcile the choices they made that led them here.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake. It is great to be with you for Soul Search. Have you ever tried to give something up? Around the world right now, perhaps billions of people are fasting from something, food or drink or something else. Muslims do it for Ramadan and some Christians for Lent. But why give things up? What happens when we refrain from something as basic as food and water? And what if we press pause on acquiring stuff, on our material consumption? I'm with Heather Fagan. She's fasting for the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Hi, Heather. Paint me a picture of what you've given up.
Hi, Meredith. So I'm fasting for Ramadan. It's the Muslim holy month. And so for 29 or 30 days, according to the lunar month, we fast from dawn until sunset from food and water. And I just love it.
Hang on, you give up food and water and you love it.
Love it.
That's a little counterintuitive to me, I have to admit, Heather. What's the hardest thing for you to give up? For me, it would surely be water.
Yes, for me, it's water as well. And I think what makes a difference is understanding why we're fasting and having that intention, I'm fasting for a specific reason. And I think that changes everything because on a day when I'm not fasting, I haven't made that intention, but if I go a couple of hours without water, then I feel that extreme thirst as well.
No, it's like death.
Yeah. Whereas now it's summer and I'm raising young kids. Sometimes I'm out at the park. It's hot, but I really want to fast. And so I don't do it with ease, but it's easier. It's much easier than I thought it would be. Hmm. I started fasting later in life and I, like you, thought, I used to think it was dangerous. I thought it was unhealthy. I thought it was unnecessary. But actually when I started fasting, it really transformed my life. It's the biggest thing that has transformed my life, the biggest ritual, the biggest practice of Islam that's changed my life actually.
I would love to hear about how you kind of came to embrace this whole new way of being in the world, Heather, and I will ask you about that in a few minutes' time. But just to stay with fasting, you said intention. I suspect there's more than one reason that sustains a practice as demanding as this. So just shake it out for me. Like, why do you fast?
So the reason I started the first fast was because everything that I had tried of Islam that I believed is coming directly from God. Because I read the Quran and I learnt about the Quran, and so I really believed there's evidence. I believe there's evidence that the Quran is the word of God. So I trusted in that. So then I thought, okay, well, if God says to pray five times a day, I will. And then that transformed my life. So then I trusted. So the number one thing is that it's for the sake of God. Like, God commands us to fast because he knows us, he created us, and he knows what's best for us. So there's part of that trust when I first started to fast, but I was still skeptical. But after I fasted, I realized there's so many benefits. And I did learn about it and read about it as well and found there are so many benefits.
And what are they?
So one is the digestive system, giving the digestive system a rest. It's like, you know, rebooting the computer. It actually needs a rest.
And a lot of people do fast intermittently for health reasons. Like, that's widespread, but you found that in your own life.
Yes, yes. The biggest thing I think in my personal life is the sharpening of the willpower. Even though I've fasted now for about over 15 years, I still get amazed that I can fast for, you know, 29 or 30 days each year when I used to get hangry if I didn't eat every couple of hours. So I was ruled by my stomach. In Islam, we would say I was a slave to my stomach because I let it rule my life. I let it control my emotions, and I used to take food everywhere. Whereas now I know I can go 4 or 5 hours without food. I'm going to be fine. And if I can put my mind to something and do Ramadan, then what else can I put my mind to and actually achieve? It really helps us with our willpower, our determination, realizing our ability, realizing our potential.
So it's a discipline of self-control that can be applied beyond the fast. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Definitely. And it should be used for that. So during Ramadan, Muslims, we try to identify a new habit or something that we can work on in our life, you know, maybe develop a good character trait for ourselves, or maybe it's reading more Quran or something during Ramadan. And then by the end of those 30 days, then we want to be able to continue that into our lives. So I'm trying to be more patient with my children.
I'm always trying to be more patient with my children. I mean, any parent you ever meet has probably got patience somewhere as one of their life goals. But I mean, fasting is probably not always the approach to cultivating patience that people take if they're not, for example, a Muslim or from a tradition that has a habit of fasting. Do you see a very direct connection between the giving up of food and water during the day and the cultivation of patience?
Yes, I do, because we have God in our consciousness all the time. Because, you know, food and drink, it's something we need. It sustains us for life. Mm. Why are we not eating and drinking? It's only because God has told us at this time, you know, a month ago on this day, we'd be eating and drinking. In 2 weeks' time, we'll be eating and drinking at this time. You know, in a few hours when we break our fast, we'll be eating and drinking just because the sun has set. So we're conscious of God all the time. It's a very spiritual feeling. And so while we're doing that, Muslims, we want to fast from everything. So we want to fast from our eyes looking at things that we shouldn't be. We want to fast from our tongue saying things that it shouldn't do. We want our body to be, you know, fasting from things that are wrong. So we try to, it's a direct correlation for us. During Ramadan, we try to be the best version of ourselves with the intention that we try to continue that through the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, each Ramadan, we have a chance again to say, hang on a minute, let's take a stock of my life and let's try to live a better life, reach our potential, become a better person.
Is the body suspect in some way that it needs to be trained? Just listening to you, Heather, I'm asking this partly because I don't know what you'll say, but there's feasting that goes alongside fasting as well. The nourishing of the body is as much as a part of Ramadan, certainly on the basis of the iftars I've ever been invited to. So I guess I'm curious about like the management of the body.
Yeah, the way we understand it is that we have what's called a nafs inside us, which is like our ego, our desires, our emotional impulses. And part of our purpose of life here on earth is to purify our nafs. So our nafs can steer towards being angry or greedy or, you know, any negative trait, or we can steer it towards good. And it's about practicing. Once you practice something, it becomes a habit in your life, then it becomes part of your character. And it's our nafs inside us that does that. So yes, one of the biggest things about our nafs is in relation to food and drink. Training ourselves in our physical desires in eating and drinking is one of the most challenging things. And so it's the most rewarding.
Heather, I think that interest in kind of being more intentional and acting in line with your intentions and your values is something that you've carried for a long time, right? How did you initially become interested in that and what that means for consumption of food or anything else? Where did that start for you?
For me, intention is a huge part of Islam. It's actually, we say every act, we have to have the right intention. Like it's the biggest part of an act. For example, if we give charity, are we giving charity to show off to people, to tell people, to have people think we're better, to see that we're rich? Or are we giving charity, you know, for the intention of helping people and doing something that's pleasing to God, doing it because we believe that this is the right thing to do as an ethical human being? So yeah, intention is a big part of Islam, and that's where that started for me. In terms of minimalism, or in Islam it's called iktisad, which means, it gets translated as frugality, but that's not right, the right definition, because it's Its actual definition comes from the root word of meaning to use something for what it was intended for. So food and drink, yes, we have to eat and drink. But how much do we eat and drink? We don't eat and drink too little. We can't sustain ourselves. We don't eat and drink too much because then we are going to cause ourselves damage.
So for Heather, fasting isn't mainly about going without. It's about realigning behaviour and intention, recalibrating what you do with the right reason for doing it. It's a principle that's sometimes expressed with the Arabic word ijtihad. More about that in just a second. I'm Meredith Flake with you for Soul Search on Radio National, the show about contemporary spirituality. Why do some religious people choose to give things up? And what difference does it make to their own lives and perhaps beyond their communities? You'll meet someone soon who's not fasting from food, but from stuff. He's given up buying and acquiring possessions. But right now, I'm with Heather Fagan. She's a Sydney-based Muslim observing Ramadan, and she's interested in how an ethic like ijtihad might apply beyond fasting in an era of overconsumption.
Traditionally in Islamic literature, it's about food and drink. There's a lot in Islam about, even it's in the Quran, about not wasting, not eating and drinking to excess, and linking that actually to extravagance and greediness and selfishness and, you know, because it leads us to complain as well. You know, we have so much, we've been given so much, and now we can just complain about, you know, that there's not a coffee flavor available or there's not, you know, some certain food available at the restaurant. Whereas if we have very, very little, when we're given even, you know, a few dates to break our fast with, we appreciate it so much. So it's that, it's the exact amount of what we need. So I have written about, you know, applying this concept of iktisad everywhere in Islam, which is part of our consciousness as a Muslim, that we shouldn't be wasting anything. So if we apply that in everything that we do in our daily lives, you know, especially in when it comes to purchasing products, consumerism, then it not only will it help the environment, but it will help us as people because we become more grateful for everything that we use. You know, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he named his utensils, you know, a cup, a spoon.
What?
This is the level of when you name something, it becomes personal to you and you appreciate it. Like think if you named your water bottle, right?
I think then, people do.
Yes.
I know people who've named their water bottle.
And then we become much more attached to it, don't we? And so we don't want to just throw it out if it's got a little dent in it or, you know, I'm being excessive. But, you know, we have that culture in the West where, okay, something's broken, just throw it out, get a new one. And we don't appreciate even just getting a bowl and a cup out of our cupboards and being able to eat with this. You know, some people don't have this. But we have that appreciation of everything that we have.
I mean, already you've moved beyond intention to appreciation and the implied, I guess, notion of gift right there. But it sounds like you see iktisad as a fairly flexible concept in the sense that it could be extended into all kinds of areas of life.
Yes.
Why do you think that? Is that something very common in Islamic reflection on this notion now? Or is this something that you'd like to see happening, I guess, as we continue to think through these ideas and Muslims do that from their perspectives?
This is what I'd like to see happen more in the West. I think in non-Western countries that people are doing this automatically. I definitely see that in the case of my in-laws where they, you know, and even my husband, he came to Australia when he like only 6 years before we were married, and he definitely has much more appreciation for not wasting things, not throwing things out. So I think it's a Western problem. So I see this in terms of environmentalism. It's much better now, but when I started talking about, you know, environmental Islam, it's there. It's all there in our texts. It has been for, you know, hundreds of years. But people's consciousnesses aren't quite there. So it is changing though. It is.
I mean, one of the things you point out in the writing you've done on this, Heather, that just struck me as self-evidently true is that for all that we know, and the scientists have told us so much about the climate crisis, knowing things, having good facts, good ideas, isn't always enough to turn the ship in another direction for us to actually change our behaviour individually or collectively. So why do you think that reviving a notion like, you know, iktisad can actually meet the challenge of consumption and material consumption in our time? Like, what confidence do you have in that? Or what place do you think it has as we all kind of reckon with, you know, the reality that we live on a finite planet?
Yeah, I have huge confidence in it because for Muslims, the number one important thing in our life is God. So there's nothing that we do in our life where we're not thinking about God. What would God want me to do in this situation? Obviously, we have moments of heedlessness and we get caught by our emotions and whatever, but this is our aim. We want to be doing what God is pleased with at all times. That level of conviction that we have, and, you know, this is probably across the board with lots of religions, but I can only talk about Islam, is we have that motivation. That motivation is God. And when we understand the importance of iktisad as a concept in our religion, not just in relation to food and drink, then it automatically gives us that motivation and we want to implement it and we're pleased to do it.
So we're talking about desire again, aren't we?
Exactly. Exactly. It's another way to purify our nafs, to reach our potential, to develop ourselves. And through that, we actually get more contentment. So this purifying ourselves, we talk about it as that it's the way that God wants us to live, but it's also better for us. We get more contentment. You know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, also said, wealth is not having a lot of resources. It's being content with what we have. You know, a lot of people talk about happiness, that, you know, the goal of life is happiness. But we actually understand it as, no, it's to be content. Because to be happy, well, we're not going to be happy all the times in our life, are we? You know, bad things are going to happen. But when we understand that we have to go through bad things in order to develop ourselves, to, you know, maybe change the path of our life, there's always good that happens in bad things that happen to us. In that way, we're content. We're not just happy.
I mean, so much of the world around us, whether we're Muslims or from another faith or no faith at all, is geared towards highlighting or suggesting to us our lack, what we don't have, what we still need, what we must acquire in order to achieve something better. What do you see as the contribution of an Islamic concept like this beyond the Islamic community itself? What do you think is transferable or scalable, I guess, to the wider human community as we all, I guess, have to reckon with our desires and with the implications of our overconsumption?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's the consequences that come as a result of living a life of iktisad. And I actually see a lot of this now. People are, you know, making the switch, maybe going off grid even and starting to make their own food because it's just cluttering our brain. We're actually not happier having much more stuff. We're not happier at all if we look at, you know, mental health across history.
Mm.
So I think when we look at the positives of what comes from it, you know, like you said, people are intermittent fasting because they see the benefits of it in themselves. So if we see the benefits of iktisad, it doesn't have to be a religiously motivated concept. You know, what's our heart telling us? What do we really want? Do we really want this new product? Or is this because we're stressed at the moment or, you know, we're overwhelmed with something?
And we want some retail therapy as a shortcut to solving it or thinking we'll solve it, yeah.
But exactly. Does it actually solve it? And it doesn't bring us that peace.
Taking that moment to think, do I really need this? That can be hard in itself. I wonder how you would break down, I guess, the steps in your own experience as a Muslim, as someone raising young children, to kind of orienting a life towards iktisad. How does that actually shake out in the way, say, you make your own choices and talk to your friends and relations about that, about these things?
Yeah, this is a really important question. In everything, it's a process.
Sure.
And so it's really difficult at first. The hardest part is starting. The hardest part is that initial time that we do something. And then it becomes second nature eventually. So it's identifying one area, like one thing that you want to implement in your life, whether it's focusing on food and drink, whether it's focusing on what you're spending. So whatever works, you know, people know what works for themselves, I guess.
Mm.
And just focus on that one thing. And then, you know, like I've found how fasting actually was much easier than I thought it would be. We find, oh, actually, look at the benefits I'm getting, you know, and then we start to get more motivation because then we've seen the benefits for ourselves implemented in our own lives. And then it naturally flows. And the important thing is not to overburden ourselves, to set our goals too high, to push ourselves too far, to feel guilty about it. You know, one small step, implement it, see how we feel. And then when we're ready, we can take another step, another step, eventually become our character and the way we live our life.
Mm. Heather, you said that you've been on this path for more than 15 years now since your initial conversion to Islam. And I've got to ask you a little bit about how that came about. I know you didn't grow up Muslim, you didn't grow up observing Ramadan. Could you tell me, like, in a nutshell, what happened and what was it that initially drew you to a very different mode of life to the one that you were raised with?
Yeah, and I didn't meet any Muslims until I was in my 20s. But then I was working in a Muslim area and I had Muslim colleagues and I met a lot of Muslims and I wanted to, and I would ask questions but not get, I guess, answers that I were complete, or I wanted to learn it properly, you know. So then I started taking a course at Auburn Mosque and, yeah, it was the Quran. It was the proofs that the Quran is the word of God, that it hasn't been changed in 1400 years, the miracles, the predictions that are in the Quran that came true. So there's a lot of evidence about it. And so I accepted that that's the word of God, but I still at that point was not completely accepting of Islam. You know, it's a very different, a lot of different rituals, things that are very different to the West, some things that are very similar. But yeah, and so then it was just step by step. I learned that praying is the most important act that we do. I thought it was ridiculous praying five times a day. I thought it would be stressful.
Did you?
Find a place to pray to, because it's about actions as well as words. So you need an actual place. And I thought, oh, God doesn't need this. Like, this is too much. But I thought, okay, if it's the most important thing, let's just try it and see what happens. And it really transformed me. I became much more peaceful. You know, it's like meditation five times a day. Then from there, I, you know, trusted more. And it's been that process, you know. Again, it's a journey, taking it slowly in my own time, which was the advice I was given. And the people around me were very supportive, not pushing me to do anything too soon. And it's really transformed my life. I feel a really different, much more peaceful, much nicer person.
Hmm. Heather, looking forward, again, in terms of transformation, what contribution do you think this way of being, these intellectual and theological resources that you found in Islam, can make, I guess, to that global and very universally human challenge of sustaining a shared life on this planet?
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it's often given a chance other than, you know, shows like this.
Are you hopeful or?
Okay, I'm very hopeful.
Okay, tell me why.
I'm very hopeful because I believe that nothing happens without God's permission.
Nothing?
Nothing. So we have free will, we have choice, but he allows it to happen if there's going to be some good that comes from it. He has the wider picture. He can understand, you know, I can't even see what's happening in the next room from me, but he can see what's in the future, what's all around the world. So I have hope. I have hope that he is in control and that he knows why all these things are happening. You know, like I said before, difficult things that have happened in my life, I wouldn't change them for the world. I wouldn't want to go through them again, but I absolutely wouldn't erase them and go back and not have them in my life because of the benefits that they've brought. And I think sometimes we have to hit rock bottom before we make changes. And I've started seeing it happen already across the wider society. I've started seeing a lot of people in the West shifting their focus from consumerism, realizing it's not making us happy. Yeah, I see a real shift starting already.
Heather Fagan is a director of the Islamic Sciences and Research Academy, ISRA, which is partnered with Charles Sturt University. Heather's been interested in environmentalism since way back in her undergrad days, and later she became a Muslim. Joining the dots, she's done some academic work on the Islamic concept of ijtihad, or frugality. Could it be part of the solution to overconsumption and environmental destruction? If you'd like to have a read, you'll find a link to Heather's article about it on the Soul Search website. It's Meredith Lake here with you. Great to have your company on Soul Search here on ABC Radio National. As Muslims fast for Ramadan and Christians observe Lent, I wonder if you've ever tried to give something up. Have you ever tried to scale back what's on your plate or in your cup, or maybe in your online shopping trolley? Jacob Garrett works part-time for a small Christian not-for-profit that's interested in economics and material consumption. He's in the middle of a personal experiment with buying or not buying stuff. Hello, Jacob.
Hey, Meredith. Good to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, it's the Christian season of Lent, typically a season of repentance and reflection in the lead up to Easter. For a lot of people, it involves fasting, but what have you given up for Lent?
Yeah, so I guess you could call it a fast, although people might get technical about fasting just being food and water. My wife and I have been experimenting with giving up acquisition, getting new stuff or even old stuff, taking anything into our lives that we didn't have before.
Wow. Okay, so what you're going to have to elaborate on what this means. Are there kind of what are the rules, I guess, of not acquiring things, so to speak?
Sure. Well, we have been making it up as we go along. This is our second time doing it. And for us, it was very important that it included old stuff, so stuff at op shops or even stuff that we find that other people have turfed, like at hard rubbish dumps sort of thing.
No scavenging the median strip or the
curb. It'd be too easy for us if it was scavenging. A pretty good date night for us is walking the streets and looking at other people's rubbish. So it was pretty important that it include all acquisition apart from, we should say, food and groceries.
Okay.
And so, medications that are necessary.
Okay, so in are food, groceries and medications, and out is date night. Jacob, what are you
well,
doing?
Well, we can still go for that walk.
And that counts as acquisition even if it's recycled or secondhand.
Yeah, that's right. At least for these 40 days. It's nothing wrong with scavenging. It's just we're giving it up for a time.
Okay. So what's the hardest part for you? Is it the curbside crawl or is it, you know, buying that pair of shoes when your runners fall apart? Like, what is it that's tough
well,
about
Well, I mean,
this?
As you say that, I've noticed even the last few days my shoes are kind of wearing thin, my main pair. So there might be a bit of struggle there if it gets rainy. But probably the hardest part, yeah, is that kind of we get in rhythms. I don't know if you do, but we get in rhythms of going to shops, poking around, seeing what's what, even window shopping that could lead to real shopping. And all of that's kind of just pointless. Like, there's not even any point going into the shop. And we had a moment just a couple of days ago where a friend of ours said, oh, come hang out. We'll go to this vintage store. And we said, well, we'll hang out, but there's not really much point in us coming to the shop because we're not going to buy anything. So in a sense, that was interesting because it showed how we are limiting our social participation in a way, how much of our ways of spending time with one another can be mediated by acquisition in one form or another.
And the example of date night is another one, Jacob.
Right.
And that's the thing is these fasting can feel, or giving up anything really, can feel so individual and personal because it requires us as individuals to make a different choice or to say no to something and maybe yes to something else. But these are social choices as well, or have at least social implications, as you say. And I mean, we live in such an acquisitive culture, don't we? This feels deeply countercultural, what you're doing. And I wonder how it is affecting. Do you find your relationships and the way you spend time with people shifts during these 40 days?
Well, certainly an aspect of fasting is shifting your attention. So whatever energy you might spend on food preparation, say, and thinking about food, you can shift to God, and that prompt of hunger is a good opportunity to reflect on your hunger for God. And I think something similar goes on with what we're experimenting with, that you do kind of just have different rhythms of how you spend your time. You know, you're not going to go out and do that date night or go shopping. And that basically just means you've got different prospects that open up for you. Probably the interesting one that happened to us recently was our car battery died.
Oh, no.
And my wife needs it for work. And
would
it was
that
interesting.
Be against the rules to
well,
get a car
so
battery?
Well, so this is the thing, right, is we didn't actually even consider it, which I think is more prompting of reflection for us than if we had thought about it and then decided, okay, this is necessary. We just tacitly, subconsciously assumed, well, we can't be without a car. And we probably would have found a way if we had decided that counts. We're not getting a car battery.
So it was obvious to you instinctively that car battery was like in the medicine category, that it was okay to acquire the thing you needed to make your car go. This
yeah,
wasn't
and
a,
it's
a
interesting
case
that
of acquisition.
I say that as someone who prefers cycling at every opportunity than driving.
Okay.
So I'm not even sort of, I sometimes talk about it as her car, not my car. So, you know, it's even for me, it's built in of like, oh, this is just necessary.
I love that a car battery is your guilty pleasure, Jacob. The thing that
well,
you've
I
kind of maybe broken your acquisition from fasting over, depending
yeah.
on how you define
yeah.
the rules. It sounds like you're having second thoughts.
No, I think it's just you don't know what you don't know until you try and do something like this. So the first time we tried it, we found it quite difficult at the beginning, and you don't really recognize how much you want or need something until you give up that, so whether it's food or anything else. And we really did feel the pull, even with the roadside dumps, which for many people might sound ridiculous, but we wanted to look. We wanted to know what was there, and we felt like we were missing out if we didn't look. What new goodies could we have gotten that could have supposedly enriched our lives?
Mm. So what is this restraint from acquisition essentially about for you? I mean, you've mentioned hunger and how with fasting from food or even water obviously points to the hunger and the reshaping of those kind of desires and cravings. But refraining from acquisition of all kinds, like what is that? Or the purpose of that for you?
Mm. So I think it definitely is about training. You know, part of fasting is about training the appetite, whether that's the appetite for food or anything else. And I think we both, when we were reflecting, we recognize in us that, you know, we're Christians. Jesus says innumerable times almost in the Gospels, be on your guard against acquisition. You know, your life doesn't consist of stuff. And we just sort of take it as a unwritten rule of our lives that maybe life does exist in acquiring. We think maybe life is to be found if I just found the right coat or some surprise turned up, some piece of furniture. And even though for, as you say, ecological reasons, we're mostly in a habit of trying to acquire stuff secondhand or from rubbish tips, there still is a kind of get out of jail free thing there of you can go, okay, great, well, I got it ethically, but maybe I still really do think life exists in acquiring after all.
Hmm. So you're kind of suspicious, it sounds, of even ethical, so-called ethical acquisition. There's something about acquisition in and of itself that seems worthy of being wary of.
Certainly not wholesale. You know, we need to acquire things in order to live. You couldn't live like this for very long beyond 40 days. Stuff wears out, you need to replace it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with acquisition. It's just I think our fast is a kind of attempt to rebalance things in terms of acquisition because we feel like our surrounding culture is pretty imbalanced and we're always acquiring more and we have so much already and we really don't need it.
You said, Jacob, that this is the second time you and your wife have kind of quit stuff or quit acquiring things for the season of Lent.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn the first time and why did you go back again?
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons we went back is because we thought it was doing us good and there was more good to do. Yeah. Like I said, our experience of it changed over time and initially it felt quite constraining. But then I don't know if you've experienced this in things in your own life, but once you give yourself no longer any option to do that thing, it kind of becomes freeing over time and you realize, oh, I don't need to go in that shop. I can't buy anything anyway. So what else am I going to do? What else am I going to think about? You know, there's no point researching my next purchase because there's no purchase to be had. And so we found that by the end of the 40 days, it didn't happen overnight, but by the end of the 40 days, we felt a lot lighter. And we wanted that experience again. We thought it did us good and we wanted more of that.
You felt lighter?
Yeah. I mean, so I am quite an acquirer. My wife less so, but I love the potential of stuff, you know. I don't need that right now, but maybe that'll come in handy. I'm a tinkerer. I like to make stuff. You never know what's going to be useful. And so it's tempting to always get more and more and more. And we experienced that we actually have so much already. We turned our attention to the stuff we already had because we couldn't have any more stuff. And we realized, man, there's actually heaps that's kind of filling our lives. And the first time we did it, we'd just gotten married. And so people had given us gifts and we just felt so glutted with stuff that we wanted to sort of put a pause on that and get a reset and also set a trend for our marriage that wasn't just focused on more is better necessarily.
Have you ever tried something like that? Pressing pause on acquiring stuff? Have you done any kind of religious fast? Because if you have, I'd love to hear what that was like for you. Drop me an email anytime you like, soul.search@abc.net.au, or you can head to our website and use the Contact Us button. You're always so welcome to share your thoughts. On ABC Listen and Radio National, it's Meredith Lake here with you for Soul Search. Maybe I'm projecting, but I suspect a lot of us would quite like to simplify life, maybe declutter some literal and metaphoric stuff. But Jacob's Lent experience is about more than the material. It's about reorienting his relationships to God and to others.
When you can just purchase all your solutions yourself, you're completely independent of other people, and you don't borrow stuff. You might buy your own thing, sort it out yourself. Community suffers. And so we actually want to foster borrowing, I suppose. It's good to realize, oh, I don't have everything I need. I need to go over to that person's house. They have the skills or they have the items I need to do what I'm trying to do. That fosters community. And so we're very big on that side of the equation.
So the kind of social interactions you want, I guess, are not so much let's browse that vintage shop together as a way of spending a Saturday afternoon, but let us indebt ourselves almost to one another as we borrow things and mutually rely on each other.
Yeah, that's right.
That kind of vision, is that what you say?
I think it's, I mean, people that seem to know what they're talking about in community talk about some level of material interdependence being a necessary part if it's going to go well long term. And I think that kind of makes sense that, you know, if you're really frustrated, whether we're talking housemates or family members or any other kind of community, if you're finding just life hard with someone, but it turns out they drive you somewhere or they have the skills you need to fix your bike or whatever, you really don't want to burn that bridge. And so there's a sort of binding agent that material dependence acts like.
It's a sign perhaps of a deeper interdependence, I wonder. Jacob, you said before that Jesus in the Gospels has quite a lot to say about life not consisting in the abundance of things, which is a little flag, I guess, that you're pretty interested in, at least the Jesus that we meet in those texts. Tell me more about your religious biography, if you like. Did you kind of grow up in a household that was interested in these things and gave it a kind of a religious cast? Or tell me what your background is when it comes to this really countercultural money story that you've embraced.
Sure. So my parents are Christians. So I was raised in a family that went to church, and the church I went to, you were always exposed to the Bible. You're always exposed to Jesus in his many modes. And through that church, I also got involved in the youth group when I was a teenager. And it was pretty obvious to me that if this guy's even half serious about what he's saying, things are going to look pretty different to how they tend to look out there. And so I would say the exact sort of fast we're doing wasn't necessarily front of mind for people going to my church, but my Christian upbringing took Jesus and the Bible very seriously, and that seriousness was imparted to me. And so when I look at what Jesus has to say and other parts of the Bible as well, it seems to me that if Lent is a time of reflection and repentance and getting serious about our faith, one of the areas that I think people like us who have so much stuff and so much ability to acquire more stuff, we really need to take that seriously.
So just step me through how you joined the dots between reading the Gospels and deciding not to acquire anything for 40 whole days. How do you understand at its core Jesus's posture as presented in the Gospels towards stuff, shall we say? I mean, he lived a pretty simple life himself as far as we're aware, but so did everybody relative to us in the West in the 21st century.
For sure. Yeah. So it's important to say stuff isn't evil. I don't think you can get
from... Do you mean
from
things or materiality?
Both. Okay. There's nothing wrong with the material world or even having things and using things and any of that. I think where Jesus becomes so full on is he's very aware of the spiritual power of stuff and spiritual power of money. We could kind of bundle those together and call them wealth.
Spiritual power?
I think the way I read him, he's saying, you know, he's got these famous sayings like you cannot serve God and money. Serve is an interesting word there. Mm. And it's almost like he's saying, where are you looking for safety, comfort, abundance, life, prosperity? These things come very close to a sort of material way of talking about what the Bible in sort of a religious word would be salvation. Jesus, I think, is aware that we will look to certain things to bring us life that is really life. And Jesus says, if you're looking to stuff to perform the role of God, it's not going to go well.
Would you diagnose our culture as doing that? Or how do you read the room, so to speak? I mean, I think we have quite an ambivalent relationship to material things in some ways.
Yeah, well, in some sense, I think we need to be more materialistic. I think...
That's not what I expected you to say. What do you mean?
My experience with stuff is if you truly value it, what it can do for you, you know, we pick up what other people have thrown out and called rubbish and we've gone, oh no, it's still good. I'll use it for this or that. If you value stuff for what it actually is, and if we're thinking ecologically, all the resources that have gone into its production and manufacture and shipping to get to the point where you have access to it, if we're valuing all those things rightly, I think we would be far less keen to throw it out. And so I think in a way, when you say we're ambivalent, I agree. I think we actually kind of don't know the value of a thing and at the same time look to things to bring us ultimate value.
It makes me wonder if it's the thing that we expect to find value in or the orientation of acquisition that you know, that we're the kind of people who can keep acquiring, is that where we expect to find some kind of sense of meaning or stability or safety? I'm not sure.
Acquiring feels good, you know, when you go and buy that thing, especially if you've been thinking about it a long time or it came up as a surprise and you got a great deal on it, you know, that feels great.
For a time, sure. We're ambivalent, but do you think we undervalue? So you think we undervalue things in some ways? Do you think we overvalue stuff on the other end of the spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, this is different from person to person, and it's, you know, you got to be a bit careful here because your personal ways of thinking about stuff might not be another person's. But take a car, say. I think the chief value of a car is what it can do for you. It can move you from A to B really quickly, in a lot of comfort. But there are a lot of cars out there that are selling themselves on the basis of doing far more for you than that. The status that they confer, the idea that I'm driving this type of car, look how clean it is, look how luxurious it is, that kind of thing. I think definitely we can get too caught up in that sort of stuff. But that's not to say that we should live a kind of whitewashed life where everything is as plain as can be and there's no pleasure to be taken in the beauty of a car or the beauty of anything that we make. So it is a fine balance. You don't want to denigrate stuff, but you also don't want to worship it.
There's something with the example of the car about individual autonomy as well, because lots of other forms of transport are shared and public, right? There's something about the choice that becomes available to us when we act in more individual ways. You've made me think about that, Jacob.
Well, I definitely think a lot of it is about autonomy. I think that's a helpful lens to come at it, that the more we have, the more power, in a sense, we have, the more options we have, you know, whether it's money or things. And like we've been saying, you don't really need other people as much. If you've got a car, you don't need the train, therefore you don't need the train driver, and you don't need anyone else to catch the train, because if no one caught the train wouldn't be there. And so you individuate out from we're all in this together to I can sort of take care of myself. And I think the Christian faith, whether we're looking at the words of Jesus or anywhere in the Bible, the Christian faith is very wary of the posture of I can do this myself, whether it's apart from other people or apart from God.
I mean, Jacob, I can imagine that some people contemplating the kind of choices that you've made, at least for the season of Lent, might think it sounds perhaps a bit austere, possibly even a little bit kind of dour or life-denying, depending on their perspective.
Yeah.
So in the midst of this, what does this mean for where you find joy or something life-enhancing? And whose lives do you think this practice or this discipline for the season of Lent enhances?
Well, it's important to say that if you're someone who's living with a lower material standard of living than is actually good for life, this practice isn't for you. I don't think we should be going without stuff to a damaging or unhealthy extent, or at least not without careful consideration. You know, I know there are people who fast pretty severely out there and it might come with health implications, but they think it's worth it anyway. But certainly in our case, we're in a position where we have heaps of stuff already. That's the sort of person that if I was recommending this practice to anyone, that's who I'd be recommending it to. It's not really for someone who's struggling for stuff. It's for people that feel themselves to maybe be giving stuff too much power in their life, too much space in their life, or maybe literally too much space in their physical home.
I mean, the storage industry is booming, the self-storage industry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We rent extra spaces to put our stuff in. Australians are really good at it.
So when you say, where do I look to for life, I think we definitely find that there's a burden to owning and it's not just all positive. You have to organize your stuff, you have to store it, maintain it, and that all costs something. It costs time, it costs energy, it costs stress. It might even cost money in the case of the storage industry. So where do I look to for life? I mean, I look to the stuff I already have. This isn't an anti-material fast. This is a fast that is designed to help us appreciate the material. And then I also look to all that time and energy that I might spend acquiring, I've now got for other things, spending time with people in different ways and exploring the opportunities that open up there. I definitely think, yeah, if you were to live your life more generally like this, it might be quite dour. But just like for a fast of food, it's not intended to say food is bad or even feasting is bad, but just for this time, for this purpose, I'm going to give up food and then I will be in a position to enjoy the feast even more. That's sort of how we're approaching it.
I mean, as we've kind of been saying, we live in a society that revolves, our economy certainly, around fairly constant consumption. But do you think this practice could be or should be scaled? Like, I mean, you've chosen it for yourselves and you've been pretty careful not to say it's for everybody. But what do you think would happen and do you think it should be tried on a wider scale than perhaps that of your own household and those of the people around you?
Well, I definitely encourage people to think about it. I can't really imagine it being sort of imposed. But I mean, interestingly, like people's reflections some years back now, but with the COVID lockdowns, people experienced a disruption in lots of different ways. And one of those was you couldn't just go to a shop on the weekend sometimes. And that did mean that they found different things to occupy their time. And some people I talk to describe that time as quite refreshing and giving them a new perspective. And so I would kind of liken it to that. I think it's beneficial in that way that if you are thinking, oh, maybe I don't want to be ruled by my relationship to stuff in the same way, this might be a good circuit breaker. And then you can reapproach stuff potentially with new eyes.
Lent concludes with the Passion Week, the Holy Week, and Easter. And I'm assuming also in your case, Jacob, with the end of this particular season of fasting from acquisition.
That's right.
How will you mark Easter? And, you know, are you going to replace your runners or is there a new purchase that you're kind of hanging out to make? Or what do you think will be next? How will you conclude this season, I guess?
Well, it was interesting the first time we did it. I had a very slow flat tire on my bike and we didn't have a very good bike pump.
Oh no.
And I was thinking, oh man, I can't wait till this is over because I'm going to go out and get that bike pump straight away. And I found that I didn't. And Andy, my wife, found that, you know, she enjoys op shopping probably even more than me. And we were sort of expecting at the start, oh, we'll just go out there and have at it. But both of us kind of got out of the practice of acquiring by the 40 days. And I think it is important that it's kind of a significant period of time. If you did it for just a week or two, it may not have the same effect. And so we both have found, and therefore expecting this time, that we won't rush out and suddenly buy everything that we were dreaming of. And probably if you're dreaming of it the whole time during Lent, that's not really the way to go with it.
You possibly haven't actually given it up.
Yeah. You've given it up physically, but you're really just spending all your thought on it. Mm. Yeah.
So how do you, I guess, redirect your thoughts? You used the word attention before, because what you're describing suggests to me that it's about more than where you spend your time in the afternoon, whether it's the op shop or somewhere else. Are there practices that you found help you orient yourself towards that different relationship? Communities that you're part of, or for some people, a meditative practice or even a form of prayer can be elements of this. Is that part of the picture for you as well, Jacob?
Yeah, certainly. So I think it's a natural pairing to pray alongside the fast that you're doing in Lent. And yeah, as part of our community church, I live in Melbourne in Coburg. We're part of a church called Grace Tree Community. One of the things we ended up doing as a result was setting up a sharing network with that church. And so sharing our stuff, I think, to express that we have so much abundance and it's available for everyone, is definitely one of the things we do beyond ourselves to express Lent. And yeah, we'll be observing Easter at church like Christians around the world.
Reflecting on this fast, this relinquishing of stuff, at least for a season, would you say that it does in fact bring you closer to God?
Yes. I mean, we'd have to describe what that meant, but...
What does it mean to you?
I think, so we were talking about attention. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you can only focus on so many things. And so if you cut one of those things out, you have more space for the others. And that's definitely true. But also, this fast for us is a reminder of our priorities and where we look to for life. Where do we think real life is found? And so in that sense, it draws us nearer to God. I mean, Jesus, like I've been saying, says some pretty scary things about those with wealth. He says it's harder for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. So, I mean, in that sense, fleeing from the lure of wealth might actually be something that draws you nearer to God as well. If you feel like you're at risk of being, and I think we probably all are in wealthy Australia, at risk of being drawn away from God and toward other gods, gods of self, gods of stuff, money, and independence.
Mm. That is a big thought and a big challenge. Jacob, good luck for the rest of your fast. And yeah, all the best for a wonderful Easter as well. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
You too, Meredith. Thanks for having me.
That's Jacob Garrett. He's a Christian observing Lent by giving up acquiring possessions. So no buying, no op shopping, no secondhand treasures. He's even quit browsing the neighbourhood curbside pickup. Jacob works for Mana Gum, which is a small not-for-profit interested in alternative economic ethics. You can find out more about it by heading to the Soul Search website. Earlier on, you heard Heather Fagan. She's fasting for Ramadan and exploring how her tradition could help meet the global crisis of overconsumption. If you missed it, you can find Soul Search on ABC Listen. Why not follow the show and make sure you don't miss an episode? Soul Search is produced on Gadigal Country by Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'll catch you again next time on Radio National, Radio Australia, and ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.